Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. Hi, podcast listeners. Delighted to have you with us today. I have got Glenn and Teresa on the podcast with me today. Teresa is a member of the Responsive Fundraising Consulting team, and Glenn is going to introduce himself in a moment. Glenn, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
I'll do that, Jason. Thank you. My name is Glenn Davis, and I'm the Vice President of Development for Simmons College of Kentucky.
And Teresa, why don't you, you've been on the podcast a couple of times, but why don't you introduce yourself as well?
Sure. I'm Teresa Lee, and I'm a senior consultant with Responsive Fundraising based in Massachusetts, and I represent the New England area for Responsive.
Yeah. So Glenn, we were talking before we hit the record button about a number of sort of dimensions about where this conversation could go today. But what I'm interested in, and I haven't heard this yet, is where you and Teresa connected, because you guys obviously know each other, and I don't know why or where. Who wants to bring me up to speed on that?
I guess I'll take a stab at it. Maybe Teresa's version is different. When I started working at the institution, I realized that probably one of the best things I could do was try to, since I didn't have formal fundraising experience or training, was one of the best things I could do as I got real world experience was also to address it from an academic standpoint. So I started looking around on the internet for some professional development stuff, and I landed on Boston University. And I did their professional fundraising certificate, which was the 13-week course that I just completed. And Teresa was one of my instructors. And it started in January and ended here, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. And so over the duration of all the modules and all the assignments and lectures and content that was presented, just got to know Teresa literally from Zoom and from interaction with in the classroom.
So Teresa, how was Glenn as a student?
Glenn was a star student, but we really got acquainted when he was a little late on assignment because he has a day job, of course. And I was kidding him because there was a Celtics player named Glenn Davis whose nickname was Big Baby. So I wrote to him and I said, come on, Big Baby, you're a little late in the assignment. So that started our friendship because he got the joke immediately. And he was an excellent student. And the way that it works is we have discussion boards, and he always was contributing to the discussion boards in a helpful manner, both for me and for the other students. So that's one of the hallmarks of a good student for me.
And Teresa, I don't think we have talked about that. So before we get started in this deep dive into the conversation, explain to us what it is, the course you're teaching there at Boston.
So it's an online course, which it's always been online, which is interesting in this day and time. So we are experienced about teaching online. And it's a 12-week course in fundraising, and it covers all aspects of fundraising. Each module has a different subject to it, everything from planned giving, major gifts, annual giving, corporations and foundations, management and accountability, you name it. It lays out foundationally every aspect of fundraising that you could think of, alumni relations, support services. And so students have an opportunity to chat both with the instructor, but also with one another and comment. They're asked a couple of questions. And then they have two assignments for each week. One, a reflection of what they learned during that week through the material. And we do a live class each week. And an assignment to write basically a one-page paper on whatever the subject matter is. We give them a question and they construct a plan most times. And then they get graded on their participation and the level of their ability to comprehend the information and to answer those questions. And we have about 50 or 60 students each 12 weeks. And you can find it on the Boston University website. It's been very popular. We always have a good cadre of students. And interestingly enough, because we're online, they're from all over the country and all over the world. And representing, yeah, you name the type of nonprofit, they are represented.
Yeah, I have to say, Teresa, when you and I met, I don't know, it's been about a year ago, the idea that you teach as well as I do and other members of our team, the idea that we're sort of a professional learning community, almost operating more like a faculty than a consulting team, is very appealing to me. So delighted to have you on the team. Teresa, you suggested that we have Glenn on here. So why don't you tee up the conversation and tell us, pose the question that maybe you'd like Glenn to sort of take us down the path to talk about today.
Yeah. So Glenn, you came to fundraising a little late. You said about a year ago, a little later in your career, later in your life. And you made a transition in your career. So tell us about how you got started in your career, your fundraising career.
Sure. I was 36 years prior to now. I was working in advertising sales and broadcasting in particular in radio and TV stations here in Louisville, and close to half of that time I was a manager of sellers, and the rest of the time I was a frontline seller. And I had noticed, and I think what I told Teresa was, is I had noticed one day here a couple of years ago where in the last 5 years that business had changed more than it had changed in the 15 or 20 previous. And it made me just realize that, that, you know, where I was in my lifespan, that that might be a situation where I don't know if I wanted to finish out the last 5 or 6 years of my career doing that, anticipating more upheaval. So I started thinking about what I could do that wouldn't require a great deal of retooling. And so, one of the things that kind of dawned on me was getting involved in higher ed at an institution doing some form of fundraising. And I had a very good friend that was wired in on several boards. One of them was, it turns out, he was on the board of trustees here at my institution. And he's, as a matter of fact, he's now the chairman of the board of the trustees here. But he asked me to lunch one day last spring to talk about the opportunity that was presenting itself here, and gauging my interest, and then set up a meeting with the college president after that. And then it was on, as the kids say.
So tell us about the college where you work in Louisville.
The college where I work is Simmons College of Kentucky. It is an HBCU. It's one of the 101 historically black colleges and universities in the United States. Many folks are aware of HBCUs. A lot of the times, as my president would say, in white space, folks would say, "Oh, that's like Grambling or FAMU with a marching band." Yeah, that is. That's part of the fabric of the uniqueness and the culture of the HBU experience. But they're wide and varied. You have the really big names like Howard in Morehouse, where you've had, you know, illustrious graduates, whether it be Thurgood Marshall or Spike Lee or Martin Luther King at schools like that. But then there's many like my institution, which are smaller, that have a mission that is very, very narrow in regards to serving an at-risk population in particular, but it focuses on one of the poorest zip codes in the state of Kentucky here in Louisville, which is probably about a mile west of where I sit right now. It's called California. And in the 2017 census tract, the average household income in that neighborhood was $12,800. So it's a real unique mission to where the mission of the school and the vision of the president, who's been in office here for 15 years, is that we're a lighthouse. He uses that many times. He's very charismatic, dynamic. We are a lighthouse to where we lower, to mix metaphors, a ladder down into that community in West Louisville to provide opportunities through education to change folks who have had the misfortune of a lot of things, just off the top of my head, and things that people could probably readily relate to, either urban renewal gone bad, redlining and gentrification has basically, in the last 50 to 60 years, in that geography that we focus on and we serve, has, for all intents, eliminated a black middle class. So it is one of the priorities of the school through what we do in regards to that education is to provide opportunities to folks to raise them themselves and have a generational impact on their families to improve their lot in life through education and the opportunities that education will provide. The other thing about the, which I think Teresa was particularly smitten with, is the history of the school. The school was founded in 1879. It's one of the oldest historical black colleges in America. The thing that's really unique about it is it was founded by formerly enslaved folks. So it came as a direct result of the Emancipation Proclamation, and those formerly enslaved people saw the value of education and what it could provide moving forward, and so. It's real neat in that aspect, because generally, if you look at the history of historically black colleges in America, most of those colleges either came from abolitionists, the foundations were from abolitionists, or were from white churches. And we're a little unique in the fact that we were founded by former slaves. And so it is a proud and rich history that the school has. There was a time in its heyday in the early, late 20s and early 30s. It had an enrollment over 600. It had a medical college as well as a law college of law. And it was pretty much viewed the way Morehouse is today, which is commonly referred to as the Black Harvard. That's what Simmons was. It was one of the shining beacons in the South, and was even mentioned, as a matter of fact, I believe it was mentioned in Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery, mentioned the institution. So it had a great history, and then the Depression came and ravaged the institution, as it did many institutions, and it never quite recovered from that. The institution from 1931 to 1951 was absorbed by the University of Louisville, and it was known at that time as basically the Louisville, the colored college for Louisville at that time. So it was segregated University of Louisville until 1951, when the first black student enrolled at the University of Louisville.
So Glenn, I have to ask, because you've referenced Morehouse. So a lot of us were watching the news, I don't know, I guess it was this time last year, when Robert Smith gave that extraordinary gift to the students at
the graduation.
At the graduation. And I remember seeing Smith's, I remember seeing the sort of the commentary that was sort of coming as a result of that decision on his part. And I almost remember sort of it thinking that it was causing people who would sit on sort of both sides of some of these, I don't know, equality issues, uncomfortable that someone was making that sort of a decision for an HBCU school. And there was a, anyway, I just saw it as a very interesting sort of way, because if an alum had made it, and I don't know if he was an alum, but if someone of his caliber, we might say, had made that decision on behalf of Harvard or Yale or something, I don't know that it would have made as much, created as much buzz, and it may not have stirred up as much controversy. But it seemed to me like the controversy was not only that somebody was making a historic gift of that size, also giving it to a particularly, you know, a marginalized group, but it seemed to sort of just stir people up in ways that I don't know that I would have otherwise seen. What's your thoughts on that? And what's the, do you sort of aspire for your students there to have the same sort of benefactor?
Yeah, I would, it would be great, in the context of my school. Morehouse is a little, yeah. it is, you know, it's like the flagship of HBCUs.
Yeah.
You know, and Spelman, you know, they're right there in Atlanta.
Right.
Both have amazing histories and amazing alumni. And from my understanding, the way they're both of them, the pricing structure for them in regards to tuition and fees and such is at the high end, much they would be, I guess, in PWIs are predominantly white institutions. So, you know, as you guys know, higher ed, there's always all these acronyms, but that they would be priced similar, like, you know, to an Ivy League or a William and Mary or a UVA or something. So that was, yeah, I think that gesture on his part ended up costing him somewhere like between $30 and $35 million to pay off all that student loan debt. And so,
yeah,
I'll tell you this, it really caused quite a ripple, and it put HBCUs on the front and center. But with my guys here, about 80% of our entire enrollment in the spring, we had 204 FTEs, full-time equivalents, that about 80% of those guys are Pell Grant eligible. So one of the huge challenges that this institution has, which falls squarely on my four-man shop, is that those Pell eligible guys, they come with $6,600 that covers the tuition for the two semesters for a school year for our school. Well, in reality, the true cost of attendance for a student based on this past spring semester is a shade over $16,000. So if you do the math on it, for every student sitting in a desk, we're upside down right at, let's call it $10,000. So with 204, that's in excess of $2 million. The institution is in the hole from the jump. So I would love for a Robert Smith to, you know, do a flyby here and drop off a check. You know, I mean, he's probably got that for walking around money, you know, so.
I think what made people nervous, and I'll stop hijacking the conversation, Teresa, here after I get this out.
Keep going, please.
I remember working with a client in Texas, I don't know, this was about 5 years ago, and it was a private school, K-8 school, that was serving a large number of African American and Hispanic children. And it was a pretty well-to-do school. I mean, tuition, tuition at the time was about 14 or 16 grand. And I remember it registering in my mind for the first time that, because I have, a lot of my consulting work has historically been in the private K-12 space. And it sort of registered in my mind, okay, the typical tuition paying parent at a K-12 school doesn't always have, we don't always have to assume that it's a well-to-do white person anymore. That there are, you know, in this case, African-American, and in the case of this particular school, 40% of the students were Hispanic students. And I thought, I've really got to check my sort of assumptions as to who has affluence and wealth in our country. And I think that's what sort of caused, and I don't remember any of the commentary that came as a result of the Smith gift, But I think the sort of the move that Smith made on behalf of Morehouse signaled to those of us in philanthropy who are accustomed to raising money, we're not accustomed to seeing a wealthy African-American individual on that platform giving away $30 million. And so I think it's sort of, it's leveling the playing field and signaling to all of us who historically have gotten very comfortable with people that look like us. And in fact, you know, if I sat down and had lunch with a guy like Robert Smith, I would have to sort of understand his cultural context and But I think even in my own case, I think my own experiences would sort of allow me a greater awareness and sensitivity to sort of what's playing out there. Do you follow what I'm sort of saying and thinking?
Yeah, I do. It is different. I mean, that's part of the uniqueness of going to an HBCU is the fact that people miss out because in the space I'm in, sometimes, you know, I'll have some people in some early onset questions, we'll talk about, well, gosh, I thought segregation ended, you know, 50, 60 years ago or whatever. And the fact that, you know, why, you know, I don't understand why we have to have black colleges. And yeah, at the end of the day, it is something that is unique where you don't see it at PWI, to where especially like a land grant institution where there's, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 kids that come from all over the world. But what happens is that there is, there's a community, a culture, a celebration of black culture and all right. that go with it. So that there is, you know, it lets our kids be, well, at any HBCU, some more than other probably, but it's what people, you know, when they think of the Grambling Band or FAMU's band, where they come out with a high leg strut and you got the drum major that's, you know, just, they're doing their thing. And I mean, that is, you know, it's like I said, the three C's, it's community, culture, and celebration. And it has so much to do with how the way black children have been raised K through 12. There's been many studies on this. Johns Hopkins has done one, the Terry School, University of Georgia. And to put a bow on, I think what you teed up there, Jason, was is that the fact that these studies show that if a black child from K through 12 have just one instructor that looks like them along yeah. the way, the yeah. outcome of how they will perform academically is exponentially increased to the good.
Yeah.
And then furthermore, that if they have two or three, it's even greater.
So yeah.
That, I think that really kind of speaks to at the heart of why black kids would choose to come to a black college as opposed to go to a PWI. Because, you know, they have a choice. They come here because of, you know, what I just kind of laid out.
So we did a seminar at another HBCU school last year. And as I was interacting with those people, they didn't seem as aware of what we're talking about, that there were Robert Smiths out there. They didn't seem to be as inclined to say that within the black community, for example, or basically within the community of anybody who's not white and wealthy, that there are individuals who have the resources who could help this school. Because this was used the word under-resourced before we hit the record button. You know, if there's 100 HBCU schools out there, how many of them are still convinced in your mind that the African-American community is truly a across-the-board, under-resourced community and are not aware that people like Robert Smith exist?
I think it's the majority. I will say this. I think there's schools, and I've got to think the way I frame this. You take Howard, Spelman, Morehouse, FAMU probably would be in there. There are – I don't know what the number is, but I think – to answer your question, there are a number of historically black colleges and universities, and those that I just mentioned would be in the number, and I'm sure there's four or five that I'm forgetting. But the experience, even though it's a black college, it probably is real similar to what the experience they would get if they had gone to a predominantly white institution. But right. It is the resources those schools have, the way it's structured, and more importantly, the population base they draw from are probably middle class to upper middle class black kids whose mom and dads probably both work, and one of them probably has it's not uncommon for them to have a really nice professional job. And with our guys, you know, as I told Teresa, 72% of the kids that graduate from this college are the first people of their bloodline to set foot on a college campus.
Right.
Yeah.
So Glenn, when we did talk, you were telling me about some of the challenges, given that you have to raise per student about $10,000 a year.
Right.
And given where you are, which you identified earlier in our conversation, what are your challenges in raising money in your community and from your alumni base? And how are you creative to overcome those challenges?
First of all, the alumni base it's virtually nothing comes. We have a micro giving campaign called Simmons Is Me. We get a little off that, probably no more than $100,000 a year. And part of that is that, from the backgrounds they come from, due to wealth disparity, which is, you know, another podcast for Jason with somebody else that's a demographer or social justice guy. But there are some realities. Basically, for every, you know, $10,000 a white household has, there's a equivalent of $1,000 in a black household. So there's the deck is somewhat stacked in regards to that, where it leaves those guys that do get degrees. I mean, what they're going to try to do first and foremost is help out their family. And so it doesn't leave a lot. So if, you know, if they got an entry-level job in sociology or, you know, cross-cultural communications or music instruction or religion or education, they're probably real limited on what they can give to us. So we do what, you know, you guys do, and that is we go look for individual donors, we look for corporate donors, and there's three huge foundations here that are local that all us NFPs line up and take our time and coming in and pitching, you know, during the grant cycle. So I have tried to focus on, as I told Teresa, some of when I came over, I had a list of 20 folks that I had pretty good relationships with in the advertising world. And so within my first 100 days, like the politicians say, I tried to go see all 20 of those guys, thinking that I could fast track them because I had their trust and I had a relationship with those guys to where I could just, you know, eliminate that step of saying establishing trust. All I had to do was just come in here and say, hey, this is what I'm doing now. Let me tell you the story. And see if I could pique their interest to where they might either write a personal check or the company that they either owned or were up the food chain on, they'd say, yeah, this is a cause we want to get behind. So that was my focus from that standpoint.
So what are some of the insights in your first year, given that you have gone through this wonderful education through Boston University, but you're on the ground, right? And now you're hit with a pandemic. So this is, you know, must be an up and down year for you, like great challenge, good start, got yourself some professional education, and now the pandemic hits and upends your plans. And yet you still have to raise money.
As I think I told you in a phone conversation we had two big fundraising events that were supposed to have taken place 5 days apart last week. One was a really nice brunch at Churchill Downs, which would have been our third year that raises net six figures for us. And the other one was going to be with a jazz concert at a iconic, right across the street from where I am, an iconic old venue called Memorial Auditorium. And we were going to have our jazz ensemble. And then we were bringing in Stanley Jordan, who is like a five-time great. He's everybody that knows jazz knows Stanley. He's a guitarist. And so those have all been pushed down to like early fall. And I'm beginning to wonder if it's going to come off then, because there's a lot of major events around here from a concert and other events that have already, they're announced that they've been canceled. So it's strange times. I looked up, I pulled a report on Monday looking at March 19 and April 19 total donations against where we are now. And it's down like 75%. I wasn't surprised at that. But I'm trying to do right now is figure out a couple of things. One is to maintain stewardship, because you can't really get in front of anybody, but check on all those who we were cultivating, and either via text, email, or a phone call, just to check on them. Hey, how you doing? These are crazy times, and hey, we're still here, and this is what we're doing. This is how we're finishing the semester. And then trying to take this downtime and come up with a game plan once the all clear siren is sounded, that, you know, can hit the ground running, you know, in regards to how what I want to do and some of the things I want to focus on in regards to a next big campaign and what the priorities for the school are from a funding standpoint.
And given the margins that you're working at, you kind of can't afford to shut down fundraising. So, you know, are you continuing to fundraise? That's the big question people are asking. And to me, you have a wonderful story to tell to any potential donors about, you know, the urgent need, which will only become greater, I would imagine, going into the fall, where the economy is taking a hit and people's pocketbooks are taking a hit. So what students might have contributed before will even be less. So, you know, you've got a pretty big challenge in front of you, both you as leader of advancement, but also your whole institution. So how are you guys positioning yourselves? What kinds of conversations are you having now to address that?
What we're trying to do is we've from, I guess, one of the greatest positives is that we had started the process with the biggest foundation here in town, which is J. Graham Brown, which is the Brown and Brown Foreman distilleries. And they have the biggest endowment of any of the foundations in town. And we had started a real in-depth, meaningful conversation with them right around Christmas and laid out, as they say, the soup to nuts of everything that is important to us right now, things that are 5 years in the future that are important to us, is even talking about positioning the institution for seeking regional accreditation, some other things that in regards to upgrades that would be required in and of that from an institutional infrastructure standpoint, whether it be technology or adding volumes to the library and such like that. So we had that conversation with them, and that has morphed to where we did a follow-up Zoom call with their leadership about 3 weeks ago, and then had another follow-up Zoom call with the folks that I call our ed team. We have one of the people that works with the school. Her name is Dr. Sharon Porter Robinson. She's from here, but she was for two terms in the Clinton administration. She was the Undersecretary of Education. She's brilliant. And then another person, Dr. Raymond Burse, who is the former president of Kentucky State University, which is a public HBCU, who is also brilliant and is very wired into education. They're helping us along in regards to this accreditation piece and getting our education program up and off the ground as a curriculum offering. So what we have done with J. Graham, we've been very transparent with them, talking to them about what I'm telling you guys about. And so had the Zoom meeting where we distilled down maybe four or five things that over a 3 to 5 year period that would be most impactful for the university, put pricing on those a la carte, and then rolled it up in total for them. Had a Zoom meeting with the program officer last week to talk about even more detail, since he would have to carry the water for us for the May board meeting for the foundation. And we found out after last week's Zoom meeting that we have been added to the agenda for the May board meeting. So we're pretty excited about that. I think that's the first time in a long time we've come through to where we got a place at the table, if you will. And especially in light of the times that we're in right now, Teresa, to where they've had to kind of had to pivot a little bit in regards to what their priorities are and their process and protocol, to where so much of, like, if you look at their website, it has, you know, economy and community building and education and stuff. So I think so much of it right now is it is across the country, I'm sure, with foundation and funders, is that being able to address, being nimble enough to address frontline needs and challenges right now when it comes to anything COVID.
Given that you are new to the profession, but not new professionally, what have been some pre-COVID, perhaps, what have been some of the joys and revelations you've had about fundraising?
I think I like the president of my school is very dynamic, and he's one of the smartest people I've ever met. He's really, really big into social justice, not only in this town, but in the region. And he's taught me a lot about that, and a lot about, you know, America's history when it comes to white-black relations. And it's done me a lot of joy to see when I go on calls with him and we call on potential individual donors, maybe at the major gift level or corporate, to where he tells the story of the school and you can see the people, either it's on the initial call or maybe it's a follow-up call, to how excited they are and how they embrace the mission of the school and the vision of the president. And it's really cool when we have a series of conversations either in person or over the phone with folks like that, and then seeing them come on board. And one of the ones that was really, really wild for me, and part of it was due to the relationship that I had in another life, because my wife used to work at corporate Papa John's at their headquarters, is that within the first 6 weeks I was on the job, we started a whirlwind relationship with John Schnatter, who is the former CEO of Papa John's. And it took probably about 8 weeks from the time we had the first call with him to where he gave $1 million gift to the school. And it was really gratifying to be involved with a lot of people that went out and met with John. And then John and his team came here for a tour of the school and sit down in the boardroom and had a long, really frank conversation about where the school is and the needs of the school. And what a long-term commitment and relationship between the two of us would look like. And so that was one of the most gratifying things for me, is when, you know, John, people not only locally, but, you know, people nationally know who John Schnatter is and who Papa John is the day that we had the press conference here and got all the local media and all the dignitaries and such here made the announcement, and that was great. I mean, and standing in the back of the room and thinking, wow, this has been 8 weeks from, you know, from the very first phone call to say, hey, can we get on your calendar and come see you, to crossing the finish line to where, you know, he presented us with $1 million gift, and then realizing that, you know, this is the start of something that's going to be more than just a single gift.
So you're talking like an experienced fundraiser. seriously, you have the language down. I think you understand the concepts. To what degree did your prior career prepare you, and what did you have to learn on the job? Because, you know, if I'm a new fundraiser listening to you, you're already the vice president of advancement, right? What do I have to know about this profession to be successful? And if I do want to make a career transition, what do I sort of have to prepare myself for? What were the differences, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And what do you know now that you wish you knew a year ago?
Wow. As I've told you before in conversations that we've had outside of this one, and that is that I'm a big believer in transferable skills. And I think at the end of the day, in some of the Zoom calls I've been on here lately, whether it's the Lilly School or the stuff that Jason's done with responsive fundraising, you know, the main thing is that, first of all, I mean, people got to trust you, and it's all about relationships. So, you know, it's like they tell you from the day one in sales 101 is that, you know, first thing that you have to do is you have to establish rapport, and from that rapport comes trust. And then you go down the path of selling whatever your product is, because once you sell yourself, and you've got where people believe in what you're telling them, that the easy part then is, you know, whatever it is that you have, because if by extension, if people trust you and you've demonstrated to them that their trust is founded, that, you know, when you come in there and you start presenting something and you have a knowledge base and you're passionate about it and you're able to articulate what the mission is of the school, just off of those basic tenets, you know, from the sales arena, you know, that's the same thing. I mean, a relationship cultivated to sell somebody a spot in the Super Bowl for, you know, the Fox affiliate, and a cultivated relationship to get someone to buy into the mission of the school and get them to write a $100,000 check for, you know, a shovel ready building project is virtually the same thing in my book.
So Glenn, I have to imagine, so to sort of pull back the curtain on what some of my interests have been, and from the first book that I wrote. So I told you earlier that I was doing most of my consulting work has been in the K-12 space. And when I started that book, it was largely to address what I was seeing to be sort of a talent, not a lack of talent, but just sort of a misconstrued or a mistaken understanding about how to identify, retain, train, and have successful fundraising talent. And I'm kind of wondering if you're seeing that too, as we sort of wrap this conversation up, how do the HBCU schools address the talent need? You know, if I go to the average case conference, I'm not seeing a lot of, say, for instance, African-Americans necessarily in large numbers who are in major gifts roles, for example. So if that's somebody you're looking for, and I got to say, I know a few of them. So if you I've met them I've had them as guests on the podcast. But where do you find these people? And if you're not finding them, meaning they're not experienced, are you guys talking about ways to create them, kind of like what you guys have done with you? You're finding transferable skills and bringing you into the space and saying, we can do this with someone who has these transferable skills.
That's a great question. One of the things I found out too here is once I got to the institution across the board, whether it's in academic affairs or it's in assessment or student services, it seems like comparable jobs, say like at University of Louisville or another school, would be like, so if this director of whatever pays, you know, X at University of Louisville, it's going to be X minus 30% here. So that it's, as you well know, talent costs money, especially if it's any kind of talent that has experience. And so that makes it tough to really fish in that pond. So it's almost, I harken back to when I was, you know, a fledgling sales manager and hiring talent, to where, you know, you've almost got to get them really early and hope that you realize that you're renting them, that you're going to have them for a year or two, because they're going to flourish and they're going to get a rep, and then people are going to come knocking on their door and you're not going to be able to keep them. But I've noticed that with this, as I said, we have a 4-man shop and have some folks with varying levels, and best example here is we have a young lady here who her main focus is to administer our CRM, our donor database. And she is probably 23 years old and a young mom, and is really bright and analytical. And we sent her to committed a 4-day professional development thing before COVID hit,
sure,
to where the Lilly School came and did some stuff here in town. And she came back just filled with the spirit and just like looking at me saying, hey, you probably got another 5 years left. And I've decided, I think maybe I want to be in a position to replace you when you retire. And this plan giving stuff, man, I think I'm all about that. And she was talking about DAFs, and I mean, she was just, you know, she was just, you know, abusive in how excited she was. So to answer your question, maybe for me, the way it happens is that it, you know, it, maybe the natural progression thing is we'll move her up and we'll replace her at the entry level, and it would just be organic and homegrown for us.
Yeah, I can really, I can totally appreciate that, because part of the, so the conclusion, one of the conclusions I came to in that first book was the idea that the nonprofit sector, and in particular, and I've actually identified that smaller, what we might call smaller, say liberal arts universities that oftentimes exist in sort of the shadows of these very large state institutions have some of the same challenges, have got to sort of get in the game of creating talent rather than competing for talent. And I think that our industry has not sort of picked up on that yet, that and that there's some serious advantages to that. Not only do you bring in fresh energy and enthusiasm, like you're describing with this young woman, but you also bring in sort of new perspectives to how this should work. And you also bring in someone who may better understand the cultural context in which they're working. And so how do we get better, less about trying to, you know, poach somebody's talent from somewhere else, who are oftentimes few in number, and oftentimes that what that experience is doesn't necessarily translate as quickly and as easily. But how do we find individuals who we can sort of create from the bottom up? That's certainly something that, you know, and Teresa can vouch for that. I think that's going to be sort of the wave of the future, is we're going to see less, you know, competing for talent, poaching talent, stealing talent from, you know, the big university down the street, to learning how to create it, and creating environments where they can thrive. Glenn, if somebody's listening to our conversation today, and they're like, I would really like to reach out to Glenn, I'd like to know more about his school, I'd like to know more about the opportunities there, maybe they just want to continue some of the conversation that we've sort of stirred up here, how would you suggest that they do that?
Jason, probably the most seamless way to get a hold of me would be my email address, and that would be gdavis@simmons, and that's S-I-M-M-O-N-S, college, ky.edu.
Perfect. Well, we will put that in the show notes. And if you'd like us to put some, we'll certainly put some information about the college in the show notes as well.
Be great.
You're always welcome back. And please feel free to refer some of your colleagues from the college or from other places in the HBCU community. We'd be delighted to have them on here on the podcast. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation. I really enjoyed my time here. And thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.